Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 141, True Eloquence, Pretas, Puppies, and Dreams.
Does anybody tell you you can fully understand yourself or the world? Where did you hear that anywhere? I don't think so. People often ask me, why did you as a young boy get so interested in Buddhism? And after acknowledging that I was suffering from a case of adolescent megalomaniacal omniscience, I say that I was annoyed by people saying on two directions that you can't understand yourself, and you therefore have to depend on their authority. And the one is the religious direction, where we are just these ignorant, sinful beings, and there's a God that knows everything but didn't decide to tell us about it, and actually made us to be unable to understand it and just have blind faith. And then on the other side, the scientists, they're going to understand this piece and that piece of this and that function or thing, but any scientist who says, eureka, I fully understand everything, of course, they kick them out. They give them some serotonin uptake inhibiting drug, calm them down, because you're not allowed to understand. Only a deluded and insane person would understand the world. And whereas Buddha said, I do understand the world. Isn't that great? Although our English word understand even shows the backwardness of our culture in a way. Why should intuitive experience of the reality of something be called understanding? You're standing under it? What do you stand under? You stand under some sort of order from above, don't you? It's an authority thing, understanding. Oh yes, I understand. It's like meaning obey. It means like somehow someone tells you and you, oh, okay, yes, right, got it. But that's not understanding, that's just receiving obediently a formulation from authority, right? Understanding. In Sanskrit and Tibetan, therefore, and other things, the words for understanding are words from the verb, mostly are words from the verb to see or to go. And so that, like, when you understand something, you go into another world. A world that is newly understood by you as something different from what you thought it was, when you have an insight about it. We do have words like insight and things like that, which are great. Intuition we have. But still, understanding is a powerful word in our language, so we have to use it. But it has its etymology gives us a sort of clue about how dependent on authority we are. Whereas our inner manjushri is our own ability to understand for ourselves, to be critical of what we're told, to be even critical of what we think based on what we've heard, and to really grapple with things and investigate them critically and then understand them at the deepest level. And the deepest level of understanding, what is that? Like, it's experiential in a certain way. It's where the boundary between subject and object becomes fluid. You, in a way, you sort of really understand something by merging with it in a certain way. You know, like the great poet Basho, he said, if you want to write a poem about the pine tree, you have to become the pine tree, and then the pine tree will express its essence through you. You know, wonderful poetic idea. So, the Buddha, of course, was, from the point of view of some levels of philosophy, he was you know, what he understood was a little bit unhelpful in the following sense. In the following sense, he said, oh, he said, profound, peaceful, sabshi trotel ursel dumaje, ursel trotel dumaje, you know, luminous, ursel, or transparent, actually. Profound, peaceful, transparent might be better than luminous. Unelaborated and uncreated, like an elixir, like a deathless elixir, is this reality I have found, he says, uses the word find, I have found, experienced, I think, in that sense. And then he said, but whoever I tell about it, they will not understand. So maybe, or sulatenji ancora mindubi, they won't get it, literally. Maybe I shouldn't say understand now. Self-conscious about the word. They won't get it. So I'm going to not speak, and I'm going to stay in the forest here. I'm going to stay alone in retreat. He said a word like that, at least in the Sanskrit and Tibetan tradition. That's what he said. So, I mean, but we know that ourselves, don't we? I mean, not about nirvana only. When you eat an apple, you cannot describe in words what has happened. You can say, I ate an apple. That doesn't do justice to this crunch and the, you know, the substance, the fiber, you know, the juices, especially a good apple. It doesn't, you know, there's something inexpressible about any experience, right? We know that. But still, I ate an apple. It was a delicious apple. So we have our different ways, you know. Oishi desne. We go like, oh, it was delicious. And we can exclaim things, but we don't pretend to capture that experience with those words. So in the very same thing, he said, you know, this understanding, the understanding of the nature of reality is inconceivable, unthinkable, inexpressible. It's beyond expression, he said, beyond words. He said. And then he proceeded, then of course he was only being coy about how he was going to stay on retreat. He was waiting for the gods to invite him, actually. You know, he was waiting for them. Promoter, who turned out to be the god Brahma, who came and said, come on, go tell human beings. Brahma, the god, the creator god of India at the time, was particularly anxious that the Buddha tell people, give them the teachings of how to understand what the reality that he understood, because he wanted people to know that when horrible things happened to them, it wasn't his fault. And if they think he created everything, naturally people get mad and shake their fist at God, right? When the real tragedy strikes them, don't they? And God doesn't like that. He likes worship vibes, apparently. He enjoys that. But he doesn't like hatred vibes. It's like when the president's, you know, positive polls go down into the 30s, his hair gets a little grayer every day. You know, he looks like, ugh. And the dumb ones go bomb somebody to try to get a little bit of a boost, you know. Smart ones wait and buy their time like our current one. Gives the loonies some more rope. So, but then he did talk, and then the word is really important. And, you know, the whole of the Buddhist philosophy, which is Buddhist science, philosophy is science. You know, materialist philosophers here, materialist scientists here, are called in basic Western terminology natural philosophers. That's where materialist science came from the branch of philosophy called natural philosophy. The very wonderful observation of things as you can see them in matter. But the Buddha, as scientist, which I consider him the greatest of scientists on our planet, he predicted 600 years ago, what Henry Stapp announced at the conference I was at the other day, and what Niels Bohr and Heisenberg announced, which is the infinite divisibility of matter. That atoms fall apart, even atoms, which means indivisible in Greek, I believe, atom. Correct me if someone knows Greek better, I don't really know it properly. But I believe atom means indivisible, and it's supposed to be that hard thing that doesn't dissolve, it has no parts. So it's the sort of building block of reality. Well, he predicted, he said, there is no such thing. Everything dissolves completely. When you complete, you go into it, nothing does not dissolve under analysis. Or rather, even nothing dissolves under analysis. Nothing is easy to dissolve under analysis because it isn't there. So that's very easy. There is no nothing. You know that ahead of time. And that's a scientific prediction. And the quantum people and high particle physics, high energy physics, they have verified that finally thousands of years later in the West. The yogis of India and other places verified it long before as a scientific thing, in the sense of knowing of reality thing, not just as a faith thing or a believing thing, as an experiential thing. When people said to Buddha, on what basis, what's your evidence that atoms are infinitely divisible? He said, I saw through them. And that, how can you see an atom? You wonder, right? We think we can't. We need a microscope. You need like even what those the Higgs boson and things that they find. They just find things shattering, and then they find evidence, trace evidence after things explode that they existed. They don't even see anything, even with their machines. So how could he mentally see atoms? Well, the mind is made of atoms, isn't it? The optic nerve with which you see is a bunch of atomic processes if you're seeing it on that level of magnification. So if you become completely self-aware by slowing down your awareness where it is aware of everything that itself is doing, you can go down to function on your machine language level, let's say, and possibly even deeper, actually. I believe even deeper, to a place where there are no atoms. I've been lately editing a translation of the Kala Chakra Tantra and its commentary, Stainless Light. And they're making a huge fuss about how a Buddha's body is non-atomic. Mr. and Mrs. Kalachakra, that is, there's male and female versions. Their bodies are not atomic because they couldn't do what Buddhas do if they had atomic, coarse atomic bodies. And in a way, that means that there's a level of energy that is too subtle to be called either material, and then once there's no material, in a way it doesn't really mean anything to say mental. So, but in a way they prefer to say mental. That's a really interesting thing. It's very interesting. Anyway, I'll come back to it later in later talk. So, this first verse, Shambhu, Megavahana, Hiranyagarbha, Anangapati, Damodara, and the other gods, all puffed up with self-infatuation, they roar their lordship o'er the world. You know, gods can be forgiven for thinking that they are super duper, you know. They are. You know, they're really. Shambhu is Shiva, you know. Shambhu. Megavahana is Indra, you know, the one who rides the clouds, you know, which can be a name for his elephant. Hiranyagarbha is Brahma, you know, the golden egg, golden womb. Anangapati is the bodiless lord, that's Kama, the god of passion, Cupid, you know. And Damodara is Vishnu, big belly. And the other gods, they roar their lordship o'er the worlds. And yet before the vision of his body, they pale like fireflies in the sun. Said a piece of devotional thing. Then down they bow their sparkling diadems in reverence to the lotuses of his feet. I pay homage to that lord of sages, the god of all the gods. So I was so shocked to read this. There are Indian Sanskrit poems like this from the Sanskrit Indian Buddhists. My favorite one, I should have looked that up for you because I don't ever remember the whole thing, but it says, may the pleasure that the gods feel when they behold the jeweling luster of the jewels in their crown diadems reflected in the toenails of the Buddha as they bow down to his feet. May the pleasure that the gods feel in that moment be your prosperity and good fortune. It's like a wonderful verse, Sanskrit verse. You know, they're bowing and they're feeling humbled by this being. And the reason that the Buddha does that, the gods are not humbled by other gods. They take each other on, you know, they're like endless universes of them. But when they, the Buddha is a being that is them at the same time. You know, you meet someone who is, who's not someone opposite you, in other words. A Buddha is a being who identifies with you completely as much as with himself. Can you imagine that? Like if you look at each other or look at me, I look at you, we are looking out of our skin at each other, right? And you're over there and I'm over here and we're different. There's the boundaries between us, right? And we're used to meeting people like that and we kind of reach, we're like, you know, my wife always says we're human beings are like snails, you know? You kind of reach out, that soft part comes out, and like little horns, and makes sure it's safe, and shakes hands or something, you know? Looks at someone and looks away, you know, and we're like that, we're in our shells. And so, but a Buddha, by definition, and there are very other beings are to a certain degrees who are in the direction of Buddhas, it's a gradual process, they completely identify with everything, if you could imagine that. Well, you have to imagine it. Like, for example, you could look at your own hand, and yet you sort of feel you're in your hand, right? But yet it's a thing opposite you. You see it over there. Like, you know, it's not sort of out of my sense bundle in the same way. My skin is there, my touch sense, but still my main facial sense bundle is sort of, this is outside its boundary. So at the same time, I see my hand as something other than me, and yet I'm also inhabiting it in a certain way. In a way, right? Because I'm identifying me as being sort of my thinking and my seeing and my whatever, you know, my judgments. And so imagine if you looked at another person and you felt you were that other person in the same way as you feel your hand. In one way, they're sort of outside, but they're also you. So then expand that identification. Now, everyone's been in love. There's a few honeymooners around who are still there, even at advanced age now and then. And in those times, then they've learned to identify with another, and a parent with a child and so forth. You know, small, especially the infant, when they're still producing only mother's gold. They're not that they don't have a repulsive side at that time. And so, you know, we have that ability to expand our sense of identity and identify with others. And the Buddha identifies completely with every other being. So when the person meets such a being, they feel different. Suddenly the sense of confrontation is diminished. I guess it's explainable if you think in the Buddha's biography, one of his miracles that he did with his father. His father requested him at some point. He'd become kind of a student, et cetera, et cetera. But the father was never completely happy with the Buddha in a way because he would tend to think, although eventually he became an arhat, but I think he did after that miracle. He was never completely happy that Buddha didn't conquer the world, you know. It had been predicted Buddha could have conquered the world, been a world emperor, you know, if he didn't go the path of being a Buddha. And so he was a king, the father, you know, like, hey, you know, family business, I have a world empire, how great. And he felt a little disappointed always, you know. So one day, when he asked the Buddha for a miracle, in the one Buddha sutra, one story, the biography, Buddha did this thing where two Buddhas came out of his heart, and then two out of their heart, and two out of their heart, and like rapid duplication like that, you know, exponential, until finally the father and everyone present in the audience felt every sort of subatomic part of themselves was just Buddhas. You know, like there was like Buddha in every like pore hair or something, you know, they were just, everything was made of Buddhas, little Buddhas, you know. And the father was like, I'm Buddha, you know, I'm filled with Buddhas. And this Buddha, this Shakyamuni Buddha. So he said to him, when he did that, he then said to his father, he said, well, Dad, I know you've been disappointed that I didn't conquer the world, but I'm pretty much all over it, wouldn't you say? and the father, it sort of shows the miracle is presented as a miracle, but it shows the idea of people, in that case consciously, but otherwise subliminally, suddenly feeling they are enfolded within this blissful presence, basically. There's no duality between them and the person that they're looking at, that they thought was a body outside of them, something like that. And then that made the father happy. Apparently, he became an arhat, attained nirvana, meaning that he himself expanded to adopt an identity with all beings. So that's that one. And I was shocked when I first translated, like, what's he doing with the gods doing this, you know? But that's the thing, you see. The Buddha is like Manjushri. Manjushri is your own genius. It isn't like, oh, I'm a great Manjushri or I'm a great Buddha and you guys just got to listen to me or something like that. It's like you have Buddha and Manjushri in your mind. When you exercise your mind and you learn and you develop criticism toward your own delusive, rigid thoughts and identifications and so forth, and you have the ability to break through them all and really merge experientially with the true nature of reality. And encouragement, the deeper encouragement of the Buddha is that that true nature of reality is actually nirvana. It is actually the third noble truth. It is bliss. So the true nature of reality is not something to be afraid of. It's not like, I don't want to know the true nature of reality. No, I want to just stay myself, you know. Bob Thurman, like, live uptown or whatever, you know, on the west side. No. Reality is not bad. Unreality is actually the problem. Even if we temporarily feel secure in it, the unreality of our self versus the universe structure is actually hopeless. We can never really control, cope with, deal with this universe as long as we are experiencing ourselves as separate from it. And contrary to what the materialists assure you, based on zero evidence, you don't get out of it just by being dead, or rather by them asserting that you don't really exist because you're just a brain and your sort of sense of a continuum of continuity of consciousness is not real. It's a delusion. And your reality is when you're deep asleep. So all you have to do is just fall permanently asleep and you'll be cool. They have no evidence to assure us of that whatsoever. Who has come back from being nothing and reported that it's a safe place for everyone to go to just by dying? Or poor Robin, what did he do? He tied a belt around his neck or some weird thing. That doesn't mean he got into a safe place. He should have known. He was in that movie, What Dreams May Come. Did you ever see that movie? He went and saved that lady from Catholic hell. Remember that movie? I really like that movie. And then he went down all these weird things. Robin Williams, he went down there. He cracked jokes and people were relaxed in hell. Anyway, never mind. Mind a bit more.
This week's podcast is an audio preview of the Tibet House US member video, Profound Wisdom and Vast Compassion Introduction with Robert Thurman. It's a part of a three-part series now available as a part of the Tibet House member archive. To learn more, please visit tibethouse.us. For more free previews from the Tibet House US member archive, please be sure to follow Tibet House on YouTube. New videos are posted weekly. Now back to Bob and this week's podcast, Tashi Dalek.
Okay, so then he goes on to, you know, Maitreya and Manjugosha. Manjugosha is Manjushri again. Maitreya is an image in that statue, that golden statue in the back of the room there, or in the front of the room there. It's supposed to be the next Buddha, Maitreya, waiting for him for a few thousand years. But apparently he's present now, very active among us, in the form of dogs, our pets. He likes to emanate amongst human beings as dogs. Maitreya does. Because dogs, do you have a dog? Oh, wow, you should. You don't like, or you have cats maybe. Oh, but it extends your life, there are studies. If you have a pet, it extends your life. It does. Calms you down, you can talk to it, you can tell it your troubles. You pet it, it comes out like, who else comes up when you come in the door wiggling their rear end and going like this? Where are you going to find a human like that? Adore you. Never mind, that's a joke. So, okay, so, anyway, that's Maitreya. Maitreya and Mandragosha, vast oceans. Maitreya comes from mater, mother, mitra, friend, and it means loving kindness and love, you know, the loving one, you know. And they say when Maitreya comes to the planet as a Buddha, the planet is in much better condition. There's no wars and no fanatics and no crazy people, less crazy people. And people much more easily attain enlightenment. He has a much easier time than Shakyamuni did, who comes during this time of special violence and difficulties and short lifespans and a lot of diseases and things, according to the Buddhist thing. Anyway, vast oceans, treasuries of jewels of eloquence, rippling with mighty waves of enlightened deeds, hard to fathom in their depths of wisdom, hard to measure in their great expanse of love. So that's really nice. Those are kind of the two angels of, actually in the chapel here in Tibet House, as traditional in Tibetan, any institution that Tibetans have, they have a little chapel somewhere, in the office even, you know, in the treasury office or something, they'd have a chapel. And then usually on the two sides of Shakyamuni Buddha would be Maitreya on the right and Manjushri on the left. But when we came here, when we built this one, His Holiness asked us to put Asanga on the right and Nagarjuna on the left, which are the human vehicles or channels of the teachings of Maitreya and Nagarjuna. So then next you have them here, Nagarjuna and Asanga. I bow my head to the feet of Nagarjuna and Asanga, who pioneered the ways for champions of philosophy with two interpretations of Sugata's sacred discourse and made that Sugata's name of Buddha, Sukham Gata, mean one who has become blissful, and made that superb doctrine of that victor shine like sunlight throughout the triple world. So now, a lot of what we're going to deal with here, the two main protagonists, actually, are Asanga and Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna is said, because there are said to be these two elements in the Bodhisattva path, the profound view element and the magnificent vision element. Or, I'm sorry, magnificent deeds, not vision, magnificent deeds element, that's right. So the view and the deeds, you know. And Asanga is channels from Maitreya, the magnificent deeds side, and Nagarjuna channels the profound view. And in this, just in the broader stroke preview, in this essence of true eloquence, the two major Mahayana schools of thought are traveled through, you could say, in their gradations. The Tibetan educational tradition in philosophy and in enlightenment, therefore, is extraordinary, the curriculum. It really is remarkable. Why? Because, let's say, the most ignorant person, the unreflective common person, let's say, who just thinks that the world is the way it is out there, and whatever culture, however they're acculturated, their reaction to it is just absolute reality, kind of things are just exactly what they seem to be, and there's no reflection about that. That person has a kind of sense, solidifies things around them in a certain way. Like that pillar, well, there's a sociological term that I love, that pillar right there has a sense, it has in it a sense of the massive facticity of its pillarness. I know it's a funny word, but if you see the pillar, you, in addition to seeing the pillar, you see like its sense of solidity and its strength and its impenetrability, and as if it really corresponds to one's concept of a pillar. Do you know? It really seems like that, or the floor or something, you know? We know from scientists with the particle physics that, you know, X-rays can go through the pillar, you know? A nuclear bomb can cause its supposed atoms at the level of having atoms to completely explode and release the energy of the strong forces in them that seem to hold their structure into, hold them into some solidity of structure, and they can become, they can detonate even, and become a nuclear, thermonuclear reaction, that pillar, right? If someone dropped an A-bomb here, that pillar would go, and turn into flame. So we know that sort of thing, but still, to us, it's just absolutely a pillar, right? So that's the at that level, that's this person who's just basically completely stuck in whatever world they are given by their culture and their sense organs and their fellows and their language, something like that. Then at the high end, at the opposite end of that, is a Buddha, supposedly. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not one, and I wouldn't even know for sure if I met one, since you apparently takes a Buddha to know Buddha, really, they say. So, but to me it makes sense that there is this gamut from the sort of most solid sort of entity, mental entity, to the most open mental entity. The reason that it makes sense to me is because of the fact of infinite continuity making sense to me. That there's no end of anything and no beginning of anything, ultimately. Things just endlessly change. So if that's the case, and if the best way of being is to be one with everything, in a blissful sense, seeing it through being aware of its bliss, that would be the best. Wouldn't that be the happy ending of the universe? Wouldn't it not be? I mean, you like to be happy, every one of you, I hope. There might be some people here. Occasional existentialist comes in and says, I like my suffering. I'm keeping it, don't you? Give me that la-la stuff. It's what makes me real, makes my art. You know? There are those people. But most of us like to be happy and have a good time. Come on. Look at you. Mostly smiling. A few serious faces. Michael, stop that serious face. Or maybe you're snoozing. That's okay then. But, so we all do want that. So the idea of being permanently, completely happy and everyone else, experiencing everyone else as permanently and completely happy by seeing through the illusion of time and seeing those even who think they're suffering, seeing how they will be able to unravel that mistaken thought, which must be a Buddha's vision, or a Buddha to become one would be abandoning beings in suffering, which he promised never to do. So it makes sense to me, that's all. It's not that I know that for a fact. Could be wrong, you know. Could be a mistake. Maybe it's just misery forever. I don't know. Could be wrong. Have to try it to find out. However, if that's the case, then one's view, what they call your vision of what the world is, has a kind of gamut from most closed, just sort of a complete victim of your circumstances, helplessly controlled by your circumstances, by considering them to be the only inevitable reality. And the other direction being completely free to make circumstances for the best of all possible worlds, for the best of all beings in the world, out of feeling the best you could possibly feel in everything, not just in some enclosed embodiment. You know, a Buddha is not in an enclosed embodiment. A Buddha has, they say, three bodies in the Mahayana, a Dharmakaya, a body of reality. So all reality is your body. But then when all reality is your body, you feel that it's a bliss to do that. That's called Sambhogakaya, a body of total bliss. Sambhoga. Bhoga means enjoyment, and sam means total. Sambhoga. And then when you're in that Sambhoga state, you are one with every energy. You enjoy being one with every energy. And therefore, when you encounter a being who has knotted up their energy so as to feel alienated and isolated and oppressed and frightened and or aggressive and angry and so forth, and incomplete and greedy and so forth, then you naturally manifest out of your bliss whatever it is that might help them best unravel that erroneous stance of theirs, since you see them as sort of part of a bliss field, and you see them fighting and creating stress for themselves, failing to really succeed in creating real stress for themselves, but doing their best to do so. And so So then in between, there's a ladder. There's outside of those who are thought of as outside of the refuge of the Dharma, the reality and the teaching of reality, so outside of that teaching. But within them, there are realists, nominalists, idealists, and some kind of relativist or something. And nihilists, there's total nihilists, and there's absolutists, definitely. Then inside the what's called the insider, which was the original word for a Buddhist, just an insider, meaning inside the refuge of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the three jewels of Buddhism, what they call the three rare and precious things, there's the critical realists. They're not able, they don't think, if they jump toward emptiness too strongly, they would become nihilistic. And because they're too concretized in a way, in their way they... their wiring, let's say, their philosophical wiring and their vision. Then there's critical nominalists. Then there's critical idealists, intersubjective and critical idealists. And then there's critical relativists, which is what the centrists are. Relativists in a good sense. Now, in Western philosophy, relativist is a bad thing because Western philosophy really comes out of a matrix, most world philosophies, but Western one, more or less totally, comes out of a matrix of absolutists, what Buddhists would call absolutists. That is, those who think that there's some absolute formula that you know, a dogma or formula that really is the real truth, you know, that it's absolutely this way or that way. You know, and there's no, that's the truth, you know what I mean? Capital T, they live and die over, and others, and they'll kill over, actually. And that, unfortunately, a lot of human beings get into that. A human being is a very unusual being in that they really are very mental beings. What other being, which groundhog, is going to go and die over being a communist or a capitalist or a Muslim or a Christian or whatever, an existentialist? I don't think so. Groundhog, it's like coming out in the winter, sees Bill Murray and runs back in. You know? So... but human has this incredible thing where our minds are so powerful that we come up with some, we have an experience and we interpret that as, I met a burning bush. We met bushes later, they were presidents and they were burning with idiocy and deceptions. And they burned our country. That burning bush, oh, it must be the absolute, I gotta do whatever it says. So the absolutist thing is a big deal. But there's an opposite of the absolutist, a nihilist, and they had him in Buddha's time. And unfortunately, the philosophers, scientists of our material scientists have become nihilists, really. They really have, in the ultimate sense. Relatively, they want to invent something, make a lot of money, and retire from MIT and found their own company and patent something. But, so they want to have a good time, which is lucky. But ultimately, they're nothing, and it's meaningless and random, and they have all these theories to convince themselves that it all doesn't matter. Whatever it is, go for it. It doesn't matter. It's finished, and it never happened. That's total nihilism. Therefore, they are wrecking the planet, because the planet is not nothing, and it cannot be burned, and it cannot be filled with carbon, and it cannot be bombed and blown up and all the stuff that they do, that they won't really turn off these machines. They claim to care, but they don't. It's in proof. Somebody gave me this shirt. Actually, somebody gave it to somebody else, and I stole it. Because I'm coming on that Sunday. I'm coming down here, finally, out of my ivory tower. Lazy professor. What? So there are these different stages. And realism, nominalism, sort of roughly. I mean, there's other names for it, but realism, nominalism, idealism, and relativism. So relativism, however, is the centrist. It's the centrist between absolutism and nihilism. And the way nihilism is a kind of absolutism about nothingness, thinking of that as the final, ultimate thing, you see. You know, the theist can be an absolutist theist, you know, God is all and all, and I'll just kill everybody who doesn't think so, you know, like, you know, those guys with the black flag running up and down in Iraq and Syria, you know, let's kill everybody. That's not bad, actually. 4 strains of live probiotics joining the microbiome community. So, so the critical relativism, I call that. The centrists are relativists. And relativism is something good in the Tibetan view, in the Indian view, in Buddhist philosophical view. Because it's not absolutist, but it's not totally anything goes nihilist. It's like there are truths that are relative and valid within a certain perspective, even though they're not absolute. And then there are relative untruths. So the relative itself has truth and untruth. But all of them, in a way, from an absolute point of view, are untruth. Because the only truth is truthlessness. That's emptiness, means selflessness. They call it truthlessness sometimes, meaning it's not, emptiness is not something you can cling to like an absolute. In a way, it is the absolute, and in its absoluteness, it's empty of itself. And therefore, by being empty of itself, it makes the relative meaningful in relative contexts, always in a context, always within a certain perspective. And therefore, love and goodness and kindness are never lost. They're never meaningless. They're never unnecessary. And similarly, the negative always has its consequence. So relativism is actually, we want somebody to relate to us. If we relate to things, the more we relate to things, the better we and the things will be, and that we will relate better, especially if we feel there's no way not to relate to them. Then we really want to make the relations really good, you could say. But I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but I'm trying to give you the parameters of the thing. So these are what, you know, the Dalai Lama likes to say, His Holiness likes to say all the time nowadays, and I'm so thrilled with it, that he is not a member of this or that Tibetan Buddhist sect, primarily, although different ones will claim him, and he's ecumenical about all of them. And he also... He is a Buddhist, but he's very pluralistic about the Burn people. The Burn people in Tibet are really like Buddhists, frankly, because they want to be Buddhas, but they don't want to be Shakyamuni Buddhas. They want to be Shenra Buddhas. They have a different Buddha, you know. But they do. They are Buddhists, really, and he considers them the fifth school, main school of Buddhism. But in Tibet, they're considered, we're not Buddhists. We're Burmbos. But we want to be Buddhas. But we don't want to be Buddhas in relation to Shakyamuni. It's a funny thing. I like to say, Tibet is so Buddhist that even the non-Buddhists are Buddhists. I think sums it up, you know. And then the fifth Dalai Lama, even in the 17th century, he gave land to the Christian missionaries. He gave 2 parcels of land to 2 different kinds of Muslims, the ones from Kashmir and the ones from Qinghai, you know, the Uyghurs. And so he was very ecumenical. And the present Dalai Lama was very ecumenical to the materialists. He goes on about secular ethics and let's be secular. And you know, he's always scolding me about being critical toward them. He doesn't like it when I do that. But I think he caters too much to them, personally. I confess. It's going to be another thing. He's just nice to them. He's nicer than me, but that's because he's enlightened. I'm not. Okay. So, respectfully, I bow to the next verse. I bow to those master scholars, best heralds of the non-decline of Buddha's teaching, who upheld the 2 systems of the champions, that's Nagarjuna and Asanga, and opened the eyes of millions of geniuses to the ornaments of the noble land of India, noli land, holy land of India. I'm sorry, it should be holy land of India. Aryadeva, brave Buddha Palita, Bhava Viveka, Chandrakirti, Vasubandhu, Stiramati, Dignaga, and Dharmakirti. The Dalai Lama says there are 17 of these great pundits of Nalanda University, what he calls. Here, Dzogchenpa lists 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. He lists 10 of them. And then there are 7 more that the Dalai Lama has in the collection of the greatest of the Indian pundits, you know. The pundit there doesn't mean like pundits on TV. It means real geniuses, you know, great professors of that university who are also great yogis and great sages and saints also as well, all enlightened people. Dignaga and Dharmakirti were great logicians, epistemologists. They were kind of, they straddled the philosophical boundary between nominalists and idealists, as did Siramati and Vasubandhu. Eventually, Vasubandhu was originally a Theravada realist, critical realist, who then became an idealist. Chandrakirti was a centrist, Baba Viveka was a centrist, and Buddha Palita and Aryadeva were centrists. Although, in a way, all of them wrote at different levels philosophically, because in the curriculum, you shouldn't jump yourself beyond where you're sort of capable of coping philosophically. It's like a gradual, they don't teach history of philosophy like in the West, because they don't think philosophy is dead in the Buddhist university curriculum, which the Tibetans still have alive in Drebung, Ganden Sera, and other institutions. They're not just monasteries, they're monastic universities, and they keep this curriculum alive. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to move from yourself being a kind of naive realist, thinking just everything is real, the way I see it, and developing more and more critical insight and more vipassana about it and being critical of different ways of describing it and seeing it deeper and deeper, and then move to where you realize that your language is constructing how you see things and your images and your concepts. And then when that becomes more strong for you, you then begin to realize that your mind is creating it, and you might become an intersubjective idealist, not a solipsistic or subjective idealist, thinking it's just all in your mind. It's in your and other people's, it's in the intersection of your and other people's minds, the world. And then finally, you resurrect, in a way, the external object like a relativist does, as a Madhyamaka. So there's, as a centrist. And so that's kind of the gamut of the worldview, of worldview identity transformation, that is the path, you know. And that's where the meditation is directed. And the meditations at all of the levels is valuable, and it helps climb the levels. But there's also always learning, and there's always critical reflection, and, you know, guiding the meditation. And then one brings together a cultivated ability to focus on a single topic without the mind wandering, and then it gets deeper and deeper. So that's what this is all about, you know. And that's why the Dalai Lama says he is the heir of the 17 pundits of Nalanda. And he's the 18th pundit of Nalanda. And it's funny, the Indian government wants to rebuild in Nalanda, but because of politics, they were directed by certain people to rebuild it without the Dalai Lama. And which means without the whole curriculum and the institutions he's kept alive in exile, and eventually will be rekindled in Tibet, because they're there. All the Harvards and Yales and things of Tibet are still there. They were all torn down to some extent, but then they were somewhat rebuilt also since the 80s, and then they've been in stasis since the 90s and noughts, again with a new kind of cultural revolution that's been going on there by a Chinese crackdown. But they'll be come back into function, definitely. Kind of institutes of advanced studies. Now he talks about himself, Tsongkhapa, and he, in 1398, when he was 41 years of age, actually when he was about 35, he was considered the greatest master in Tibet, actually, more or less, by everybody in all the different sects. He studied with people in all the different sects, and he was invited everywhere to teach. And then Manjushri said, "Hey, where are you going?" You know, because he had learned to talk directly with Manjushri. He used to see him sitting like an orange guy sitting in a blue globe, who would come like manifest in the room there and say, where do you think you're going?" "Oh, I'm going to go teach over at Yale. You know, they want me to come there for a semester. That's like, you know, Daichen Monastery or something." And Manjushri said, "No, you're not." "So what do you mean I'm not? They invited me." "Yeah, but you shouldn't be teaching yet. I mean, you can teach some book, but you know more than you think you know, and you're not ready to teach. You need to go on a long retreat and purify yourself, and I'm not answering any more questions. I answered all your questions, you know all the answers, But you're just not, they're not transforming you yet because you haven't taken them deep enough. You have to go on retreat and purify yourself of your karmic obscurations, he said to him. And you can take 8 companions with you and get lost. Oh, no. And then Dzogchen's colleagues were all mad. They thought he'd gone crazy and he was having hallucinations and that he, you know, he was like wanted on the faculty to go out and teach, and he's leaving, and people were really upset. And he disappeared. He went to this Olka Valley, beautiful place in central Tibet called the Olka Valley, with his 8 friends, and he did all this. He did 3,500,000 prostrations, full prostrations, 3,100,000 each to each of the 35 Buddhas of compassion. He did 100. I don't know how many mandala offerings, and et cetera. There's a set of things that you do. Like, and he did all those, and he meditated, and he reread and reread and reread all of these things. And then one morning, he had this dream. And in the dream, he was in Maitreya's heaven, called Tushita, in Tibetan, it's Ganden. And in that heaven, there are a bunch of self-indulgent gods, the Tushita gods, the satisfied gods. Tushita means satisfied, or happy, joyful. But then there also is a Dharma center there where Buddhas stay before they come to Earth for a few thousand years. They stay there. And that's where Maitreya is supposed to be living now as head of that Dharma center. So he was there in the Dharma garden of Maitreya in his dream. And there was Nagarjuna and Asanga and Dignaga and Buddhapalita and Chandrakirti and all his idols, you know, these great, great thinkers, these like champions, you know, the great pundits of Nalanda that the Dalai Lama talks about. And he was so excited in the dream, and he wanted to go and listen to their, and they were conversing about the critical centrism, critical relativism. And then one of them, a tall one, sort of dark complexion from South India, whose name was Buddhapalita, he recognized, came up with a copy of his commentary on Nagarjuna's wisdom book, which Dzogchen was reading in the daytime in his retreat cave in that place. He was in the retreat from the retreat. He was up in a cave above on the mountain at 17, 18,000 feet. And in what's called the Yamatung cave. And then brought the commentary and touched his head with it in the dream as a blessing. And then Dzogchen woke up. And upon waking, he then took out that book in the 18th chapter, the first verse, and we started to look at Buddhapalita's commentary on that thing. And it was that verse in the 18th chapter where it says, the self is neither the same as the aggregates. Aggregates means the physical body, the sensational body, the conceptual body, the emotional body, and the consciousness body. You know, the five layers of the psychophysical processes, which is just a heuristic way of sort of seeing the different degrees of subtlety, different layers of yourself as a being. And so the aggregates are, you know, the relative processes that are going on. And he read that line in Nagarjuna where it says, the self is not the same as the aggregates, nor is it anything different from the aggregates. And his finger was on the page when he read that. And then he achieved what he considered like complete enlightenment. And this is what I really like. He said that it was the opposite of what he expected. The opposite. He said, now I, he didn't really say complete enlightenment. He just said, now all the subtleties and all the perplexities are gone. I've completely got it. Then everybody else calls it enlightenment. Mental enlightenment, at least. In a tantric sense, there's a little more to go there with the body. But in the mind, he had completely done it. But then he said it was the opposite of what he expected. That reality was the opposite from what he'd expected. I really like that. I didn't used to like it, but I like it. I like it now. I hope, I think. It's like the big disappointment, in a way. But he was totally ecstatic. And then he immediately wrote The Essence of True Eloquence as a poem, which I translate in this book before the great, and it comes to be known later as Legxian Yinbo Chuan, the smaller essence of true eloquence. And then the larger one, that's also, it's called the Greater Essence of True Eloquence, which he wrote then, that was in 1398, and he wrote that in 1407, so 9 years later he wrote the greater one, when he was writing a commentary on that book of Nagarjuna's. And so this is then he says here, he claims he got it straight, he understands. There have been many who did not realize that place, that means reality, this place, but he says that place. Although they strived, were not lowly in accomplishments, from direct experience, were learned in the doctrine, and even dedicated themselves to the path of philosophy. And then the commentators say this refers to some of his predecessors, who he greatly respects, but he felt that none of them had gotten to that place. He did feel that. This place, that place. The place that he was surprised to get to. But I have seen it quite precisely by the grace of my guru, Savior Gosha. And I am, that's Manju Gosha. And I am going to explain it from great love. Listen with reverence, you who aspire to peerlessness in philosophy, with the critical discrimination that realizes the thatness of the teaching. Thatness is another description for the that place for reality. Actually, I saw briefly a Star Trek film that I had never seen all the way through in the past on TV the other day, called, I think, The Rebellion or something. It was in one of the movies, and in which, you know, they come to this place, this planet, where there are these rings that make everybody rejuvenated. And it's like a sort of hippie commune of these people who live there, and they're hundreds of years old, and they're young and vital and energized. And then some evil people are going to, like, extract the energy from the rings and destroy the planet and destroy the whole story, and then he rebels, you know. But then he falls in love with the lady who's 350 years old. She looks like a really delicious 45. And he says to her, you know, I'm attracted to older women, Picard does. She's 350 years old. But she does this thing where, at some point, sitting with her, she says he's rushing ahead, he's a Star Trek officer, blah, blah, blah. You know, and of course, he saves them from being destroyed by these bad guys eventually. But there's one point where she blows from a flower, and pollen comes out from the flower, and then everything sort of slows down. And he's like in this infinite moment. He has an experience of being an infinite moment. I don't know if you remember that. It was beautifully done. And it's like Picard, it's like really like that. So that's like thatness. Thatness means, the great mystic Meister Eckhart, I think he called it Istigkeit in Germany, isness. You know, where suddenly the things are just inexpressibly amazing as they are. And in a way, they seem like perfect. Everything seems perfect. Without look, shaking your head. You must have felt that sometime. We all have, I hope. And so there's that kind of moment like that, which is completely ungraspable and it's inconceivable, and usually it disappears, although Buddhahood is that forever, actually. In the middle of even seeming motion, even, it's like that. It's all still. Motion is an illusion, as Nagarjuna points out in his second chapter. So that's what thatness is. And there's two ways of experiencing that. There's thatness and there's suchness. And such means like that, but not exactly that. So the thatness is where the thing as it is transcendent. And yet it's a thing, but it's also everything. And suchness is where the thing as it is disappears, kind of, and everything is there, you know. You can only say it's like that. It's not actually itself. Thatness and suchness. Anyway, they're very cool. So anyway, that's what he's going to do in this great book.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, visit tenzingchogyal.com. This podcast was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. For a complete listing of all upcoming events, please visit bobthurman.com. To learn about special intensive retreats and programs with Robert Thurman and friends at Menla, please visit menla.us. Located just 2 hours north of New York City in the heart of the Catskills. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. Please be sure to like and subscribe on iTunes and your favorite podcasting platform.